Good morning, Portland, Maine. All over Maine. It is Saturday, April 30th. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O on News Talk, WLOB, 1310 AM, and also on 100.5 FM. That is a recent development at WLOB, so now we're simulcast on both stations and also available online at TideSmartRadio.com. How are we doing today there, Emily?
Doing pretty good. How are you?
Never been happier.
Glad to hear.
After getting through the blizzard earlier this week.
I know.
And we still have one little section behind the building that has this little clump of snow. And here we are on the verge of being in May. And what's really depressing about that is I think it was last year we had some snow on Halloween or maybe the year before.
Yep.
So if October gets snow and May virtually gets snow, it leaves us 4 months in Maine that you can, you know, kind of rely on and being snow-free with June, July, August, and September.
Well, you don't move to Maine unless you like the seasons.
I know, but it feels like the seasons and the weather patterns are getting a little zany. I think we're due for some decent weather. Hope that happens soon. We have an interview in just about 6 minutes that we recorded a few days ago with Drew Dumpf. He's the founder of the Ecology School. Fascinating guy and great work being done by the Ecology School. So that'll be up in just a few minutes. And let's see what else we have here. On this day, April 30th, to our listeners, you're probably familiar with this format because typically we start each show and we kind of review on what happened historically on this day. And some days have 2 pages of information. You know, some really interesting birth dates, some interesting invention days. But on April 30th, there is a real lack of very little happened on this day. Why is that?
Luck of the draw, I suppose. April 30th is just a quiet day around the world.
I know, but we've got 365 days, and some days just randomly are, you know, the day that penicillin was invented or the day that George Washington was born. So on this day, the original Land Rover debuted in 1948. That's not much. On this day, 1997, which I think this is significant, Ellen DeGeneres, well, the character on TV played by Ellen DeGeneres, announced she was gay in 1997, 19 years ago.
Yeah. First time a female, I think first time any sitcom had a lead that was out and gay.
Yeah. And I think we've come a long way. What else do we have? Birthday, Stephen Harper. He was the first prime minister in Canada to come from the Conservative Party. Well, that's kind of interesting. I asked you before we went on, before we get to this interview with Drew Dumpf, if you had watched Game of Thrones. And I was a bit incredulous. You said no.
I haven't.
Like,
not a single episode.
That's unbelievable.
Not a single clip.
Wow.
I know.
Well, it started last weekend, and I am a fan. It is so well written. Even the production, even the intro to Game of Thrones has this kind of this artistic rendering of this make-believe world. There's dragons. I mean, who doesn't like dragons?
I suppose I like dragons. I can get behind that.
Dragons are good. But really, it depicts kind of an interesting period. Well, it's mythical, it's fictional, but it's thousands of years ago, but pretty barbaric, but great acting. And again, I'm really pushing the dragons. This week, it looks like Donald Trump, although he hasn't achieved the numerical threshold to be the official nominee, he certainly looks like he's picked up momentum, which is fascinating. But it just feels like Donald Trump isn't a very nice guy.
No, I would agree with you there.
And as the U.S. is really kind of the beacon of hope and leadership for the whole world, the idea of the Donald being not just the symbol of America, but really the voice of America, really scares me. So then you have Ted Cruz, who just selected Carly Fiorina, and he's not even the nominee. He's mathematically out of it in terms of being the nominee, at least on the first ballot, and he went out and picked a vice presidential candidate.
Well, when you're falling behind, you have to do something to catch up, right? Do anything at this point?
I know.
Desperation move?
But here's the thing. And when George Bush first picked Dan Quayle decades ago, I thought that was a little bizarre because Dan Quayle, I think he was a senator from Indiana. He seemed like a peculiar choice. When John McCain picked Sarah Palin 8 years ago, that seemed bizarre. And now with Carly Fiorina, because my thinking is that for anyone in either party to pick a vice president, their candidate or nominee to run on the ticket, they have to be able to turn to the public, look them in the eye and say, if something happens to me as president, this person is qualified to be the leader of the free world. And given the tragedy that has happened to presidents in office, it is not a long shot.
Mm-mm.
And if you turn to the American people and say, oh, I think Sarah Palin can be the leader of the world, or I think Carly Fiorina, who's never held any office, she hasn't been on a local school board, to my knowledge, she hasn't been on a town council, she wasn't a governor or a senator, she ran a company only for a few years, and the idea that she could ascend to the presidency if something happened, if Ted Cruz was elected, and that she would be the leader of the free world.
Also fascinating.
Bizarre.
Yeah.
Bizarre. Finally, my column this week, did you happen to read it?
No, not yet.
Oh, geez, Louise.
Not yet.
For listeners, pick up your forecaster or go online. I wrote a column about one of my favorite TV characters, George Costanza on Seinfeld. By the way, Jerry Seinfeld apparently is coming next week here to Portland. But, you know, George used to have this line where he said, it's not a lie if you believe it. Mm-hmm. And I make the comparison between George Costanza and some of our either elected officials or people running for office. So, you know, read
that.
Sounds
like a good one.
Yeah, let me know. If you had a column, I'd read that every week.
Oh.
I would, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah, well, let's test that. Anyhow, thank you for listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O. Let's go to our interview with Drew Dumpsch. He is the founder of the Ecology School, and we will be back again next week after this interview. Thank you. Welcome back. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. And we're also on FM, too, right now?
100.5.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, this is our theme music for our guest. Please join me in welcoming Drew Dumpsch. He is the executive director of the Ecology School. Welcome to the show, Drew.
Thanks, Steve. Glad to be here.
Did I, beforehand, you gave me the pronunciation of your last name. Did I power through with the right German accent?
It was a perfect Germanic accent, Steve. I appreciate it.
Fantastic. Want to talk about the work that you're doing at the Ecology School, a lot of really cool things, but why don't we start a little bit in your background, kind of leading up to where you went to school and what brought you to Maine, and then we'll talk about the work that you're doing.
Great. I'm actually a Michigan boy. Grew up in farmland central Michigan. And
people always hold up the hand. So where in the Michigan hand did you grow up?
Well, unfortunately for our radio listeners, they can't see it, but I'm doing the mitten,
yeah.
And it's right in the middle of the palm.
Oh, wow.
Big Rapids, Michigan, just north of Grand Rapids.
I actually worked in Dearborn, Michigan, and lived in Farmington Hills.
Oh, wow.
And Michigan is one of the most beautiful states in the country, but it's also kind of the juxtaposition of kind of the industrial structure and the history of the auto industry, which created a lot of collapse in the last decade. So there's such a juxtaposition between a beautiful state and a state that's really facing a lot of hardship now, right?
Yeah, and that could say Flint is in the news so much now with the lead water crisis.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of links into the whole rural, urban, environmental protection. And I'm sure we'll be talking about that in the next few minutes even.
So you grew up in Michigan, And then you went off to University of Tennessee?
Yes.
Go Orange?
I was actually a English major, which throws people off. The fact that I've been running a nonprofit education organization for the past 17 years, and I'm an English major, means I actually write pretty good grants and press releases, and it gives me kind of edge in helping people understand ecology by using language.
So with English, did you study a lot of Hermann Hesse, a lot of Siddhartha, a lot of, you know?
I was more the, like, Thoreau and the nature, Emerson, those guys.
Hunter S. Thompson, Fear and Loathing?
Yes, Hunter S. Thompson, actually, yes.
Oh, what a classic. Okay, then you also went on to Kalamazoo, right?
Yes, Kalamazoo College was a small liberal arts school, and I was working at WQCB up in Bangor. This is way back in the late 80s, and first kind of fell in love with Maine, and then had some friends who were working down in the Saco area at a residential environmental learning center, and this is early 90s, and ended up coming out, and my wife came out too, and off and on since 91, we've been in southern Maine.
Yeah, it shows here in your notes you worked as a naturalist in California.
Yeah, I spent a year in the Santa Cruz area working at a residential environmental learning center. And
Deb, what was your question about that as we were going through?
I can't say. It's bad.
When you see the phrase, Drew worked as a naturalist, Deb beforehand said, isn't that like people nude sunbathing? Like,
naturalist and naked just kind of go together with me.
It's almost like the kind of like astronomy versus astrology.
Yes.
But not the same thing.
Well,
so.
Fantastic. No, we're open-minded here at Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O. Deb, just as a good journalist, wanted to make the clarification.
That's right.
Okay.
It's good wine country, I can say that.
Okay.
Definitely great wine country.
So then what brought you out here to Maine? You know, from your experience growing up in Michigan, studying English, spending time out in California, what was the first catalyst that brought you to our great state?
Yeah, there was the Stone Environmental School, which was founded by Wally Stone back in the 50s, had a site where we have our current campus at Ferry Beach. So I came out and started working as an environmental educator in 91 and just fell in love with the idea of being outside, working with kids. I grew up being outside all the time. I was in a 4-H group. I had a grandmother who'd take me bird watching as a kid. I'd camp and hike. And so I had that kind of outdoor ethic, and that's what I enjoyed doing. So the idea of getting paid to get kids outside, learning about ecology, learning about sustainability was fantastic. And it really tends to be the people who are attracted to environmental education are a very positive, save the world, work with kids, high energy people. And that really drew me to the field. So I've been in the field now for 26 years doing environmental education.
For listeners that may not be aware of kind of the technical definition, and we'll talk about the ecology school, but what is ecology in terms of the study of, in terms of kind of the root focus?
You know, the simple, what I like to tell people, ecology is the science of making connections. What ecology does is bring things like biology and geology together to really see how living things, or as we say, the biotic factors, plants and animals interact with the environment, how they take in sunlight and grow, how things like rainfall or things like even earthquakes or hurricanes affect the environment. So really ecology is this wonderful science where you take yourself as a human being and place yourself in the environment.
Wow. So in 1998, you founded the Ecology School, is that right?
Yes. My colleague, Steve Signell, and I, Steve was a landscape ecologist who had gone to University of Michigan, founded the Ecology School late in 98. And by the fall of 99, we were doing programming at our current campus at Ferry Beach. And since that time, Steve, we've worked with over 150,000 people. A big chunk, about a third of that, has been through our residential programs. And the way I describe residential environmental learning centers, it's not like a camp where individual kids come. In the spring and the fall, we're booking an entire school. Just last week, we had all the seventh grade students from Lincoln Middle School in Portland come for a 3-day program. So our campus, we have dorms that accommodate up to 180 kids, plus their classroom teachers that come with the school and parent chaperones. So the kids are spending up to a week going to the beach, going to the forest, learning about ecosystems, and then even, I think more importantly, figuring out how those healthy ecosystems connect into their own lives, where their food comes from, economy, education, linking ecology to the kids' broader life. So when they go back to their own home, to their own school, their backyard, their schoolyard will mean a lot more to them.
Interesting. We have Drew Dempshire. He is the executive director of the Ecology School. Their website is theecologyschool.com. So why don't we start with the actual physical campus? So why don't you describe to the listeners visiting the campus? You mentioned dorms and you mentioned outdoor activities. What is the size and the scope of the physical campus of the Ecology School? And then we'll talk about kind of curriculum and how it operates.
Sure. For the past 17 years, we've actually rented a summer camp facility, the Fairy Beach Park Association, to do our spring and fall programming. And it's about 36 acres on the southern end of Saco Bay. What's been nice about being in Saco, and I've worked as an environmental educator and naturalist in different parts of the country, but in Saco, especially on the coast area, you can walk out, and within walking distance, you have eight different ecosystems: salt marsh, forest, ponds, Tupelo swamp, beach, tide pools, all these areas. And each individual ecosystem becomes a classroom, an outdoor classroom that we can teach kids in a very hands-on, fun fashion about ecology. So the current campus has a dining facility, three dorms, and then some staff housing, because our seasonal educators are an amazing group of educators. Many of them, they're in their 20s, they're already out of college. They've been working either in the classroom or other science centers. And then we assemble this group of 16 educators every term that do the bulk of the teaching. And the lessons themselves, the study groups, it's only about 10 kids per group. So they're coming from their school, where it might be 25 kids in a class, to have a small ecology study group where it's only 10 kids and are one of our educators, is really a great way to learn more quickly and more in depth, because it's a small group.
So do you work with various school systems relative to their students interested in ecology coming? Or
yeah, we are currently partnered with over 70 schools throughout New England. Work with a lot of Maine schools, but we're also working with schools in New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Vermont. We've even had schools come up from Texas to do our programs. Predominantly public schools, Steve, but also some private schools, Montessori schools. But really what the Ecology School does really well is we partner with public schools to promote science education. And that's not only with the kids, helping kids love science by being outside, but we're really inspiring the classroom teachers. One of our programs that I think we're most proud of is what we call the ecosystem. And that word means we're using ecosystems to teach systems thinking and STEM skills,
right?
Science, technology, engineering, and math. And through our ecosystem program, we partner with Maine schools, either an entire elementary school or middle school. So we'll work with kids like kindergarten through sixth grade, or with Lincoln Middle School that I mentioned earlier, sixth, seventh, and eighth grade. So it's a multi-year sequential programming. So we get to work with kids and teachers year after year after year. And then the kind of capstone of that multi-year program is doing a residential program at our Fairy Beach campus.
And what's the business system in terms of whether it's tuition, or is there any type of public or private funding? And is the Ecology School set up as a nonprofit, and kind of how does it function from a business standpoint?
Exactly. We're set up, we're a 501c3, so a nonprofit educational organization. Our business model's interesting in that we're solidly revenue-based for many years now. We're close to about $1 million budget, but about 80% of that has been through program fees. And I think that surprises other folks in the field, where they're having to do an incredible amount of fundraising just to stay in business. Our fundraising is really focused on the scholarshiping of students. Every year now, we've been averaging over $250,000 worth of scholarships to schools, and focus, of course, on the lower income schools. Say like a Lincoln Middle School is, I believe, like 60% free and reduced lunch. So, I mean, there's real economic need there. And what we're really good at doing is finding schools that want that outdoor experience but may not be able to afford it, and then really teaming up with them. And actually, today in the studio, we have our development director, too, Brian Matluck, and he has been doing a fantastic job reaching out to both private foundations, corporate supporters. I mean, a good example would be our two big corporate partners right now. Poland Spring has been sponsoring the kids in the Poland area and also the Hollis area with programming for years now. And then Pratt & Whitney sponsors the Lebanon, the SAD 60 school district and program. So it's not only private foundations here in Maine, everything from Davis Family Foundation, Cohen Sewell, a lot of the big foundations have been supporting us, but we're having corporate sponsors has really been an important part of our model. So it becomes a community, and it's the Ecology School is a nonprofit partnering with public schools and then partnering with foundations and businesses too.
Great. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM and also 100.5 FM. We have Drew Dumpshire. He is the executive director of the Ecology School. When people think about schools and they think about curriculum and they think of accreditation, ecology feels like there's a lot of sub-detailed sciences, but in general it feels a little amorphous in terms of environment. What credentials do kids get, and do most of the folks who attend, are they attending for greater understanding and love of the environment and the various kind of ecosystems they interact with there in the campus, or is there a kind of a vocational professional path that you found that it translates into kind of a vocational interest?
I like that question, Steve, especially the amorphous part, because it feels, I think, folks, there's definitely people who major in ecology and become an ecologist for a living, but part of our focus, the Ecology School wants to popularize ecology, to say that ecology as a science of making connections is helpful for all people. So there's that kind of generalist approach we take, that ecology can help kids make connections between food systems and energy systems and green building. And for teachers now with the whole idea of innovation in education and 21st century learning, what ecology does, it's a way to kind of integrate learning, to pull the disciplines together. So instead of, here's math in one bucket and here's English in another, why don't you fuse those together? So really, part of our model is to integrate learning and make it a very holistic, relevant, real-world experience so that kids, when they leave, especially the students who work with us, say, 5-6 years in a row, that they have an ecological lens that they can look at the world and figure out how things are connected and how they, as one person, can make a difference and make the world a better place and more sustainable. So it's that kind of generalist. But on the other hand, I got to say that given, the focus on STEM, science, technology, engineering, math, I think ecology is a great way to teach those skills and start creating students that will stay in Maine and do STEM-related careers in Maine, especially with our kind of resource economy, farming, agritourism, all those different areas of the economy that are very important.
Is there a pathway here in Maine to go in from secondary education to advanced? Does UMaine offer or USM programs for kids that are exposed to ecology and then they want to go to get a more advanced degree or experience?
I think you're seeing more and more that whether it's University of Maine, University of Southern Maine, definitely the liberal arts schools, whether it's Colby, Bates, Bowdoin, Ecology of the Atlantic, Unity, UNE, all of them have different classes and different ways that you can. I'm thinking specifically UNE now is really focusing on aquaculture and the Maine coastal economy. In fact, right now we're in talks with UNE. One project we'd love to do with them is do a permaculture course this fall where UNE students are helping us design our new property, the farm that we're about to purchase.
Well, let's talk about that. It's been in the news for the last few months.
Yeah, front page news.
Yeah, Saco City Council approved zoning to allow Ecology School to build campus on farm.
Yes.
So why don't you bring us up to date on the news and the purchase of Riverbend Farm on Simpson Road, and then talk a little bit what the plans are for building the future campus, I guess.
Great. So as I mentioned earlier, we have been, our current campus has been a rental campus, and really it's been to be at Ferry Beach has been great in our initial stage of growing and innovating, but at this point we're not able to do summer programming at the Ferry Beach campus. We basically are just doing spring and fall weekday programming. So we knew early on, long-term, we would want our own site. And really, back in 2004, we helped build a green building at the Ferry Beach campus. It's where our offices are. And we knew at that point, green building was great, but since we're a residential program, could our food service, when kids are sitting down to meals in our dining hall, how can that be good sustainability education? So that's where our Food for Thought program, our food systems program, really started more than 10 years ago. And as we started expanding our small organic garden on site, we started committing to buy more Maine food, more organic food. All the food that is coming out of the dining hall is from scratch, like our homemade pizza dough with Maine organic grains, things like that. We knew that food systems and farming was becoming a more important part of our program, that we would combine the really cool ecosystem exploration with kids, but then the best way to apply ecology knowledge is through often food systems and sustainability. So we knew early on, this is even several years ago, that we would like to buy a farm. So almost a year ago, May of 2015, the Riverbend Farm came on the market, and it's actually just 20 minutes up the road from our current site. It's a 105-acre farm. The farmhouse was built in 1794. The barn is the 1840s barn. They're in great condition.
I'm looking at a picture here. That's unbelievable.
It's gorgeous. And what's great, Steve, is the topography. It's a gentle rolling hills down to the Saco River, which at that point is between two of the dams on the Saco River. So it's very wide, kind of slow moving. The farm itself has half a mile of frontage on the Saco River. So it's a real mixture. There's a couple of ponds, forest land, fields. And for us, really, when we were looking at a new site, we wanted to stay in southern Maine. That's where our client base is. And it's tough for schools. I mean, we could move way up north and buy an old summer camp, but that would be 3 hours further north and more expense for our school. So we wanted to stay in York County, and we needed that mixture of ecosystems, which are our classrooms. And Riverbend, with its 105 acres, not only has that incredible farmland, but it has forest and ponds, the Saco River. And we're not going to lose the beach lessons because, you know, once a week we hop on a bus and take the kids down for a beach day at Ferry Beach State Park, and they get to see the tide pools and the beach and the salt marshes. So we're not losing any of our classroom space. We're gaining farmland because our long-term goal at Riverbend would be to grow at least 50% or more of the food in the dining hall, if not on site, in partnership with local farms. And you talk about, you know, often when you talk about sustainability, you talk about food miles. For us at Riverbend, would be food feet.
Wow.
You know, you're just walking those potatoes the kids had planted in the spring and harvest in the fall. You walk them right up to the dining hall and prepare them right there. So I think that's important.
Deb does that at her house. She like you're active cooking.
We're sustainable, sure.
Really? the decomposable Pizza Hut boxes.
That's
are,
right.
Or some? What do you?
There you go. Cardboard's a good starting point there, Deb.
That's a secret. Don't you live down by there, Deb?
I live in the Biddeford area. Yeah.
Oh wow.
So I'm familiar with that.
That's
area.
That's Biddeford's known as the greater Saco area.
Of course,
isn't it?
Of course.
Kind
it
of
is.
A suburb.
Biddeford, actually, we are doing a first through seventh grade program with Biddeford. And actually, Saco and Biddeford schools are going to be really important partners at Riverbend because they're the most immediate schools right there. So to have students, the kids and parents and community members from Saco and Biddeford be active participants in Riverbend Farm, both learning about ecology and having mm-hmm. fun in a beautiful spot right on the Saco River, but also learning more about local agriculture.
Deb could be an ambassador, the Biddeford ambassador.
That's right. That would be a blast.
Yeah. And I'm so impressed with Biddeford. There's so much positive energy both downtown. We was meeting with the superintendent, Jeremy Ray, in the fall and talking about just the plans for education mm-hmm. and for economy. And of course, UNE is a important entity.
UNE has been doing some great things. I mean, I think we have a lot of great schools, and the three big liberal arts schools are obviously very well recognized and accomplished. Yeah. But UNE has really come on strong in the last 5 years in terms of lots of programs involving environment. They have a pharmacy school. They're doing a lot of things in health and wellness. Mm-hmm. And it feels like they have the right size and focus that they're not facing some of the headwind that USM and the UMaine system has because of their infrastructure and their cost. So UNE feels like they're probably doing some of the more progressive things in the state.
Yeah. We had a fantastic – I sat down with President Rapitz and Dean Jeannie Hay and some of the department heads to talk about moving forward. And there's real excitement of the ability of the Ecology School as a really well-known educational nonprofit teaming up with UNE as a university, just from even a research standpoint, an education standpoint. I had mentioned that potential permaculture class in the fall is an example of that kind of partnership moving forward at Riverbend Farm.
By the way, we have Drew Dumfrey here. He's the executive director of the Ecology School. Is it .com or .org?
.org.
.org. Yep. So it's the ecologyschool.org for more information. Yeah, we've had Danielle Rippage here, the president of UNE. Mm-hmm. And about a year ago, I was at some function or dinner or some community function, and she didn't recognize me. And she was sitting at one table. She came over to my table, and it was when they were bringing the cake around.
Oh.
Yeah, I remember it. It was chocolate cake with vanilla frosting.
Who could forget
and
that?
Who could? And she reached over. There was an empty seat next to me, which for some reason is not unusual. And she goes, "Hey, can I have the extra cake?" And I go, "Dr. Rippage, it's me, Steve Woods." She goes, I know. I just want the extra cake.
Oh,
no, I'm saying that with love. UNE and Dr. Rippage do a great job. Talk a little bit about, we talked about the Riverbend Farm. So where do things stand relative to zoning and approvals within the town? And it also, you were quoted in a recent article saying that You know, over the next few years, you're looking to transition from your current location to possibly in 2019, slowly morph into the new location, and then it may require an investment of $5 to $7 million.
Exactly.
So I guess that's Brian's job in the next room is to find five or seven.
It's a team effort. Brian's helping keep it going.
He's helping.
Board, foundation.
So talk about where things stand, and also kind of the design features in the building itself and how listeners could be involved if they're interested.
Excellent. Our current timeline, we're hoping 3 years from now that we'll be fully at Riverbend Farm. And the exciting thing in moving ahead, we're actually currently working with the USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, has a financing program through their rural development program. So we're working with them to finance not only buying the property, which we hope to close on at the end of the summer, but then even moving ahead with the whole project. And we were meeting with our, we work with Bangor Savings as our bank, and they would be a partner in the whole construction phase too. And we're also working with CEI and the Small Business Association. So we're really assembling what I call the best and brightest, almost this kind of big project think tank to get the best businesses and minds on this project, because it's going to be a big one. I mean, right now we're about to head into master planning for the summer, but to fundraise and to design the project and to move ahead is going to be big. But really, we're hoping in 3 years to be there. What we're hoping, I had already mentioned the property is 105 acres. 96 of that acres is actually under easement, which actually, for some folks, they look at an easement on a property, of property being protected and development limited as a bad thing. As an environmental education organization, we looked at that easement, said this is fantastic because then we can model how people can be on the land and protect the land and improve even the land through good farming practices. So 96 of the farmland acres of the farmland is under easement. The other a little less than nine acres is the farmyard, and that's where doing new buildings is possible. And we actually have assembled not just one architecture team. We're working with Kaplan Thompson, Scott Simons, Bryburn, who just did your amazing building too, Steve. And then our landscape architect is Richardson Associates, which is right in Saco. So it's a four-firm architecture team. So some of the best green building and permaculture folks in the state are working together on this project. And we're actually going to be pursuing the Living Building Challenge, which is really the most rigorous, comprehensive kind of green building certification in the world at this point. I don't, at this point, if it sounds like this project will be the first living building project in the state of Maine.
Well, where do things stand with the land trust? I know there was some reluctance in terms of the folks, the board members, in terms of you guys.
It's still, I mean, it's interesting because I've, you know, what's been fun with the project and really interesting is I've been reaching out to the wider land trust community. I've met with over 20 different land trusts, and this includes the big players like Maine Farmland Trust and Maine Coast Heritage Trust and Nature Conservancy Maine. And the wider land trust community has been incredibly enthusiastic and supportive because where land trusts are heading, actually their big conference, the Maine Land Trust Network Conference, is this weekend coming up starting today and then tomorrow. But there's this real acknowledgement that conservation has to be more than putting a dome over a piece of property and saying hands off, that the more you can involve the community in conservation and do things like, say, the Brunswick Thompson Land Trust with their farm and their farmers market up there, that there's really exciting projects where you involve people and the land together. The current Saco Valley Land Trust is a smaller land trust, and they're unstaffed. They're the ones who hold the current easement. I think, you know, the challenge has been this is obviously a really big and bold project. And the working with Saco Valley Land Trust is giving them the assurance that big and bold doesn't mean the land suffers. In fact, big and bold in this case means doing things like a carrying capacity study where over years we analyze how people farming the land and learning about the land and recreating on the land not only doesn't damage it, in many cases it can make it a more healthy land. Regenerative land, things like climate resiliency. I mean, these are big topics now that, you know, if the climate changes, how will that affect farming? And can we model ways to grow food and to do recreation that will really be a benefit to Maine? So that's where we're at now, is really trying to work not only with the land trust that holds the easement on the property, but the wider land trust community. So this can be, you know, a partnership and assure people, whether it's the neighbors right up the road, the city of Saco, York County.
When do you think it'll be resolved? I mean,
next few months. I mean, there's definitely, we're working and we're hoping even, you know, the process of sitting down, mediation, sitting down, talking, having assurances. And one thing that was really helpful is that the Saco Valley Land Trust went right up to the Attorney General to weigh in on the project. And I'm happy to say the Attorney General weighed in our favor that
Janet Mills, right?
I'm not sure who was actually doing that, whether the actual Attorney General, but the office reviewed. And part of it, even we've been talking with folks like Karen Marchetti, who's the legal counsel at Maine Coast Heritage Trust. I've been chatting with John Piotti, who's head of Maine Farmland Trust. And they are two people who actually helped craft the current Maine Land Trust statutes that are on the books for how easements are to be, upheld and in some cases amended. And so, I mean, I'm really impressed that the Maine Land Trust community is a very progressive, very professional, and that They're really doing some amazing projects. In fact, right now, one of the collaborators I helped found, it's called Environmental Living and Learning for Maine Students, the ELMS Project. What it is the partnership of the five residential environmental learning centers in Maine. So the Ecology School, Chewonky, the two 4-H camps, which would be Bryant Pond and Tanglewood, and then the Skudik Center up at Acadia National Park. We have been working together for 6 years now. And it's funny, some people say, oh, well, aren't you competitors? You're doing the same thing. I said, well, the fact that we are doing the same thing means we should be working together, because only maybe 15% of kids in Maine now get the residential environmental learning experience. So by working together, the five residential environmental learning centers through the ELMS Project, we've raised over $2.6 million in the past 5 years to scholarship schools like Lincoln Middle School, who I was mentioning earlier. And it's not only a fundraising venture, it's a way for us to do research together, five organizations researching the impact of this type of programming on students, and then also being able to partner up. And even recently, we've been talking to some land trusts about the way environmental education and land conservation really intersect and are part of the same movement to a more sustainable Maine.
I know it has nothing to do with your work here at the Ecology School, but have you been following at all the issue going up north by Katahdin in terms of the national park, in terms of land use? And do you have any thoughts on that? Because we've been talking about that in the last few weeks, because it's a funny issue in that the owner, Roxanne, it's set up in a trust that her son, Lucas St. Clair, is running.
Oh, it's Vail Plantation. Yeah.
And so here she has tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of acres that she paid for, that she's paying taxes for.
Yeah.
And I believe the cliff notes are she wants to donate them in maybe a two-step phase of as a monument and then as a national park. But there are folks up there that are really opposed to it. And I don't know if it has specific easements, but I think the argument is that right now a lot of people have access to the land. And even though it's owned by her or the Elliott Plantation, there's a feeling that we don't need more national parks or more space like that. You know, what's your thought on it?
I think public access is a crucial need for the 21st century. Appropriate public access, because there'd be public access on land that might destroy it. We don't want that. But there have been numerous studies that when more parkland, whether it's state or local or national, people want that, enjoy that. Even thinking like in Saco and Biddeford, the new, like the Riverwalk Trail, when those are built, or the Eastern Trail, people love those. I lived in Chicago and worked at a nature center for a couple years. And when Cook County and surrounding Chicago started building walkways and nature trails there, they were flooded. People just love them. So I think there is that want and need to get out in nature. And what's kind of interesting about the whole national park up north, that idea is that really for it to work, it's going to have to be a combination of environmental needs, economic needs, cultural and historical needs. And I think that's what they're, you know, working through right now. I've got colleagues up there, and it's hard as the forest industry shifts. And I don't think the forestry industry is going to just collapse. And I know even now the whole biomass, the legislature's taking up some bills there. But there's definitely change happening right now, and change is tough. In fact, at the ecology school, we started out with four basic concepts. I already mentioned abiotic, or the sunlight, soil, non-living things, biotic. Cycles is one of our C's, but we have a second C that we teach kids about, and it's change. That nature changes, humans change, economies change. It just
climate
happens.
Changes,
climate
Deb.
Changes, yep. Exactly.
Deb doesn't believe that, so you may see her come flying through the studio.
Okay.
No, she doesn't believe that because, we good-naturedly joke back and forth, but I happen to, you know, based on my Needham High fourth grade, early science class that led to high school class, I like to believe in science, math, gravity, stuff like that, right? And I believe that there's some clear and compelling evidence that the climate is definitely changing. There's definitely a correlation. And we've had guests on from UMaine Climate Department, and you know, we've talked isotopes and all the research. But it's such important work that you're doing at the Ecology School. By the way, we have Drew Dumpsch here. He's the executive director at the Ecology School. Their website's theecologyschool.org. In the next couple of minutes, talk about Maine and ecology, because we have notoriously a relatively weak economic engine. We have some challenges that are particular to our state. We have 35,812 something square miles, 488 municipalities, and 1.3 million people spread out in a very decentralized way. And from an economic sense, the new economy favors density and efficiency. So Maine has some real hurdles. I think looking at sustainability, looking at new energy sources, looking at ecology are all areas that are natural to Maine that we should focus on, not only because it's good in an educational environment, but it's also good, relevant business in thinking, whether it's in academia, whether it's in business and building practices. Talk about your feeling working in this field and then working in education relative to the Ecology School, how you feel ecology in Maine has evolved and how it could really play a bigger role in the future.
Yeah, I'm going to show my English major side right now, Stephen, like link ecology and economy, because they both come from Greek root words, and ecology is eco, home, and logi, study of. So study of home, which I love, because the idea of the earth being the broader sense of earth, our home. And economy is actually home, care of home. So economy. So the idea that economy and ecology can really are coming from similar root words. And I think ecology is can be for the 21st century, especially for Maine, ecology can help economy be more local, sustainable, community focus.
It can be agriculture. Yeah. There can be new approaches because we have land. We have lots of land. Yeah. Aqua ecology. We have ocean. So we have, whether it's an energy source or new food sources. So we have that stuff, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's our natural benefit.
I was reading recently that Maine was considered the breadbasket of the northern seaboard in the 1800s. So there is a history of Maine in agriculture, and I think by using ecology, because ecology too, I think ecology is a systems approach to looking at the world, and that often when you look at problems we're dealing with economically or education, we take this very linear. Here's one problem, we'll tack on a solution. The more we can look at the whole system. I think an example of that right now is the Maine food strategy movement, where they're trying to link the farmers, the growers, and the people doing aquaculture, but it also includes who's distributing the food. Things like Brian and I were just at the Source Awards that Portland Press puts on now, and we were sitting with someone from Central Meat. They were one of their new meat processor up in Gardner. And what we're learning is that for quite a while, if you're growing chickens or lamb or cattle, there wasn't even a place to process that livestock. So really this move back to like having local the infrastructure is crucial. And that's really an example of that kind of systems that what's happening in education affects the economy, and that if we can, through programs like the Ecology School, have kids understand the importance of natural resources and linking health and wellness to being outside, then they're going to be more active citizens, 21st century citizens, who then understand the impact of agriculture, aquaculture, the forest industry, because I mean those are huge to Maine.
Right.
People, you know, and especially when you're thinking of tourism, people come to Maine because it's beautiful and the environment is stunning, and that even you go to Portland, the amount of incredible restaurants that are using local food, I think is really impressive. So I think that's where ecology can be used as a way of connecting economy, education, culture, community. It's exciting. So I think the Ecology School has a really exciting and important role to play with many other partners as we move ahead.
Do you have any students or faculty or connected members in this area of the state? We're in Falmouth, Yarmouth here.
We actually, I want to, Brian's, our development assistant, Diana Grandani, is actually a student. The very first term, fall of 99, she was a student from West Newbury, Mass. So we even have an alumni that is working for us. And actually, part of our research now, it's called Most Significant Change Research. We find alumni, kids who are high school or college age, people who have done the Ecology School program, to find out the impact that going to the Ecology School has on them as they continue their education and then get out into the workforce. And we've been getting some really exciting data from that in the past year.
Well, we may need somebody from the Ecology School coming out and consulting with us, because we just got zoning approval a few months ago from the town of Falmouth to build a non-commercial greenhouse here on our campus. And we will be working on that this summer and having it open in the fall. And the idea for the greenhouse is to have it open for employees for fruit and vegetable, but also to work with local school systems to have students volunteer in the process of cultivating the fruit and vegetables, and then having all that product donated to local food pantries in Preble Street and uses like that, non-commercial. So it creates a kind of a learning environment that has proximity, and it's also for our campus here, which I think you saw the new building, Viridescent, which is the first net positive building. These buildings are all linked through a solar panel, and so we believe in sustainability and green. And so I'd love to do some more with you all and learn more about the curriculum. And, you know, as we build our greenhouse and get more involved in this area, you know, kind of continue the discussion.
That's fantastic. And what you just described, Steve, you are an amazing systems thinker. What you just described there with that greenhouse, you just linked education, health and wellness, homelessness, economy. Yeah. You linked all these things, in some cases current challenges, but you're offering solutions with something as simple as a greenhouse and growing produce.
I mean, what you're talking about your existing campus and your new campus is using, you know, an element of the earth as a platform, as a learning environment. My philosophy here on our 7-acre campus is, even though our primary function is a business for about 50 hours of the week, it doesn't mean that we don't have a responsibility to the community or responsibility to the environment. We have free electric vehicle charging stations to induce people driving by to just, you know, use clean energy, and water reclamation. And we're really excited about the greenhouse. So this has been really interesting. I really appreciate you coming in today. And I think this will be the start of many discussions we have going down the road.
Thanks, Steve. This has been a lot of fun, and I appreciate it.
It's been great having you. We've had Drew Dumsch here. He is the executive director. If you have any interest or family interest, or you have children or grandchildren interested in this area, please go to theecologyschool.org for information. They're doing some exciting things down in Saco that are really contributing not only to academic learning in the subject, but also just awareness and understanding, which are the first steps. You've been listening to the Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM, also 100.5 FM. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week.